The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Living Well into the Future with your host, Julie B. Adler, where we introduce you to guests of all generations whose lived experience and expertise informs and stimulates us toward discussions and actions that foster living well ourselves and in our communities. We are grateful for the many comments we received about our last episode, Gen Z's Resilience, which you can find wherever you get your podcast. We're pleased that it was useful to you in exploring the issues with your own families and friends. We welcome your comments. Write to us to let us know if this or any of our other episodes have given rise to discussions or actions on your part. Let us know which episodes were relevant to your life, what you want to hear more about. You can reach us through our website, livingwellintothefuture.net, where you can get more information about our guests, show notes, and information about past episodes, or you can write to us at lwitf22@gmail.com. Over the past several months, we have been exploring resilience from a wide variety of perspectives through community development, community justice, education, and in personal trauma and personal experience. In this episode, we're going to change the lens on resilience as the episode explores how art contributes to healing and resilience in medical settings and in their role enhancing community building and personal well-being. It touches on topics such as the impact of art on patient care and the integration of humanities in medical education. Today, we are going to be speaking with a team working to educate medical students, heal patients, help reduce loneliness, and even improve nutrition through art. Our guests are Dr. Joel T. Katz, Brooke DiGiovanni-Evans, and Megan Carleton. Dr. Katz is a primary care physician at Harvard Medical School and an infectious disease specialist at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, where he also serves as Senior Vice President for Education. Along with Brooke DiGiovanni-Evans, Dr. Katz is the co-founder of the Center for Visual Arts and Healthcare at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Dr. Katz is the recipient of the 2024 Pioneer Award from the Foundation for Arts and Healing. In addition to being a co-founder of the Center for Visual Arts and Healing, Brooke DiGiovanni-Evans is director of the Visual Arts and Healthcare Program at Brigham and Women's Hospital and a lecturer with Harvard Medical School. Brooke is a part-time faculty member at Northeastern University and Boston University and on the board of directors for the National Organization for Arts and Health. Megan Carleton is the program manager for expressive therapies and mindfulness practices at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Zakim Center, and a board-certified art therapist and licensed mental health counselor.
Thank you. I'm your host, Julie B. Adler. We have with us Dr. Joel Katz, Brooke DiGiovanni-Evans, and Megan Carleton. Welcome to Living Well into the Future. We'd like to talk to you today about healing art. Let me start with you, Joel and Brooke. Can you tell me how you came in 2022 to launch the Center for Visual Arts and Healthcare at Brigham and Women's Hospital?
Why don't I start and then I'll tag team and hand it off to Brooke. And thank you very much for inviting us to participate tonight. We appreciate that. So before I went into medical school to become a physician, I was actually a commercial artist, a practicing artist. And when I went to medical school, I wasn't sure how it would all ever come together, but I was confident that it would in some way. And then fast forward to about 25 years ago, I was teacher at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and the dean approached me and said he had some students who wanted to integrate what he called the humanities or arts into medical education. And he wasn't quite sure what to do with them and would I meet with them. And I agreed to do so, and I shared their proclivity to this idea that art can help in so many ways in medical care, in patient care. And to make a long story short, we started a course on physical examination, of which the core skill is inspection, careful, unbiased, accurate inspection of patients. So that's where I, with the students and some other faculty at Harvard Medical School, we designed a course that turned out to be very successful. And it introduced me to many great arts educators, of which Brooke is one. And then the work has grown in many ways. It's grown to cover other areas of medical care, other populations of health care providers like nurses and social workers and other staff members and patients themselves. And the amount of requests we were getting to conduct such workshops and activities and the sort of need to justify what we were doing and understand it better through research all pushed us to decide that we probably needed to formalize our approach, which is where I approached Brooke DiGiovanni Evans, and I'll have her take it from there.
Sure. Thanks, Joel. So yeah, my journey started with Joel 14 years ago, I think now, teaching a pilot program at the Museum of Fine Arts Boston for medical residents. My background is in art history and education, and Joel's heard this story many times, but I got pulled into teaching this group based on a pedagogy that I knew and just fell in love with the work and really felt it was so fulfilling to use art in an interesting way to enhance skills, to think about wellness and healthcare, and to bridge those two worlds. Yeah, fast forward to 2020, when I started working at Brigham and Women's, thanks to Joel. 2020 is when I started full time there, and it took us a couple of years to ramp up and found the center, which started in 2022. And as Joel said, the goal is really to work with providers across the Brigham and Women's Hospital system. So I work with nurses, I work with residents, I work with attendings, I work with chaplains, and also work with medical school students at Harvard Medical School, which is an affiliated school, because Brigham is a teaching hospital. So we do workshops for anyone across the hospital environment.
When you say work with, what you're doing is presenting the educational framework or the programs itself?
It's to teach healthcare providers how to be more effective teachers in healthcare. We don't directly teach patients, and we don't do direct patient care, but we're making sure that the faculty and the residents and the fellows and the nurses and the students are all exposed to great teaching that utilizes fine arts as a core part of our methodology.
Can you tell our listeners about the programs you're doing with medical students and how long it's been going on and what kind of response you get to it and what the benefits are?
Great. It's a perfect question. Brooke, go ahead.
Yeah. So our workshops all center around using the visual arts to help build skills. And so that can be communication skills, observation skills, teamwork, cross-disciplinary work, thinking about multiple perspectives. And that can be with medical students, or as I mentioned, nurses or more senior clinicians. And we use the works of arts to take a step back and to reflect on what types of things art can teach us. And so I think art is really good at helping people slow down, communicate what they're seeing, obviously build their observation skills in what they're noticing, and work together as a team to understand and interpret the piece that's in front of them. And so all of that is brought into these workshops. All the workshops take place at a local art museum. It could be the Museum of Fine Arts, it could be the Gardner Museum, and they take place in the galleries with original works of art. So we're having those conversations and those discussions in conversation with the works of art and then debriefing about what skills and what takeaways back to clinical practice can there be from what we just did together as a group.
Could you describe some of the benefits?
I would say that with our earliest programs, we were focused, as I mentioned, on the inspection aspect of physical examination. We actually studied medical students who had taken our course or who had done alternative physical examination training. There was 10 sessions at the MFA, each session 2.5 hours. And we showed that the students who had been in the course were more able to accurately identify unique observations in patient images and were able to connect form and function and were more able to provide nuanced explanations that were likely related to their conditions. That was our base point. And since then, as Brooke has mentioned, we've really ventured out into other areas, teamwork, and we have look at whether how teams function before and after they participate. And it turns out they're much more efficient. There's less hierarchy in communication, more direct communication. We've looked at wellness and help some students process their emotional reaction to the challenging life of being a physician. And each particular curriculum that we've developed has different outcomes that are of interest to us. And in general, they've all been positive. And I would say they're absolutely popular. There's no question about that. The effectiveness of them is still being studied, and it's harder to imagine. But we're particularly interested in competencies that are hard or impossible to teach in the hospital, where the hierarchy is so rigid and the intensity of the activities is so demanding that it's very difficult to pause and think about communication styles and things like that. So the short answer is, I think that studies have shown that they're positive, and the demand of the students and the other learners has shown that they're popular, and we think they're valuable.
So a couple of follow-up questions come to mind from that. And one is, you're an infectious disease physician, and we've been through the pandemic. I've been speaking with therapists about the trauma and how to deal with resilience and trauma. And one of the things that they made listeners aware of is that the therapists, and Megan, you may have experienced that, are traumatized as well as the patients. And so does your program assist the physicians in reacting and resilience to the kind of things that they see normally and then extraordinarily?
I think I told you, Julie, but the listeners may not know that my deep nasal voice is because I actually have COVID myself right now, for which I apologize. My voice is not always as deep and resonant and radio-like, perhaps. But as an infectious disease physician, I absolutely, like so many others, struggled through the early days of the COVID epidemic. And as importantly, as a hospital administrator, I saw firsthand the struggle of the frontline providers, the nurses, the staff, the dietitians, the horrible inequities that this pandemic exposed in our healthcare system, in our country. And so there was an enormous amount of trauma, as you correctly point out. I think that Megan, who's on the line, may be the best person to answer that in the question, in the sense that she deals more directly with patients. But what I would say is that trauma has many flavors, and that is not always specifically what we're addressing in our activities. But I will say that I think there is ample evidence that underlying trauma can be more easily accessed, maybe, and reflected upon in a place like an art museum, which is where we work.
Now that Joel and Brooke have given us an idea of the history of the Center for Visual Arts and Healthcare, aspects of the program, and the response from medical students and other healthcare professionals, let's turn to Brooke for an understanding of the underlying tools they use. Brooke, we've spoken in general about using art in your work, but can you tell us first what techniques you use in your program and then why you use those strategies?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Visual thinking strategies, I would say, is one of the core pedagogies that we use in teaching in the hospital with clinicians, or that I use anyway. And it's been used for quite a while. So it was created by Philip Yenowin and Abigail Hausen many years ago, I think in the 80s, if I remember correctly, and originally designed for elementary school children and for looking at works of art through open-ended questions and a facilitated discussion. But since then, its use has been used in many different ways with adult audiences. There's a lot of research around using it in clinical settings with medical students. There's a lot of research on residents also. And what is great about visual thinking strategies, on the surface looks very simple, but has a lot of layers to it. So it's based around three questions. What's going on in this image? What do you see that makes you say that? And what more can you find? And through those three open-ended questions, the group that's before you looking at a work of art has a conversation around the work of art. And so they each share what they're noticing, why they might be noticing certain things. And as a team, they build an interpretation of a work of art. So it's a really nice warm-up in that anyone can answer what is going on in this work of art. You don't need an art history degree to answer that question. But there is a lot of sort of nuance to the facilitation of visual thinking strategies conversations. It's about bringing in multiple perspectives. It's about honoring slow looking and silent moments for people to reflect and to think. It's about using evidence to build on your observations and discuss your observations. So all of that, I think, and Joel can speak to this more, really translates well to clinical work. What do you see that's going on with your patient? What do you see that makes you say that? And so I think there's a nice kind of transfer of that. Also, a lot of the skills of really honoring multiple perspectives, working together as a team, all of those are really important components in healthcare environments.
I would just add, if that's okay, another aspect of the VTS, which I think is so well suited to medical care, is that art is inherently ambiguous. No one ever knows exactly the intent of the artist, and there's multiple interpretations possible, and it honors the ability to withhold judgment, to embrace ambiguity, to entertain multiple possible explanations at the same time without premature closure. And we know from other fields of research that those are characteristics that are more common in successful healthcare providers. And you also asked about this issue of slow looking. Can I address that?
Please.
And Brooke is a star at this. But in some fields, they talk about type one and type two decision making, quick and slow thinking. And as a physician, or as a nurse, or as a physical therapist, or an art therapist, you have to be able to do both of those. There are moments when someone comes in with a sore throat, and they have an exudate on their tonsils, and another family member had strep, and the answer is strep, and you don't really need to spend a lot of time cogitating on that. And that's the type one rapid thinking. But there's a second type of thinking that, if you are aware, is necessary in more nuanced and complicated situations. And trauma, I would say, is a good example of that. There may be very subtle clues of someone's performance or abilities or mood being affected by trauma. And in order to do that, you really have to slow down your thinking and listen carefully and back and forth with the patient, if you will, before you settle on what the diagnosis is. And art is just so uniquely suited to learn that type of thinking, the slow thinking. We will ask our students to sit in front of an artwork sometimes for, it's very hard to do it for a minute, but we'll often ask them to do it for 10 minutes or sometimes 20 minutes. And the more you sit there, the more you recognize your own biases, the more you find new information that you really didn't see in the first pass, and the more you'll recognize your own propensities and patterns of rushing through things, and also the more you'll learn about that painting. And an ideal healthcare worker, we hope, will be one who will be able to move back and forth quickly between this quick decision-making and slow decision-making, and then be able to share it with their colleagues and learn more from them.
Your explanation of how slow looking works to foster particular important skills shows its value to physicians. How did you make the connection between art and medical practice? Was it your unique upbringing
and capacity? Thank you for asking, but unfortunately, it was not my unique upbringing or any of our unique upbringings. This visual arts and healthcare is a small thread within a much larger field of medical humanism or medical humanities. And there are similar parallels that can be drawn to music and healthcare, to dance movements and many healthcare conditions, to narrative writing and poetry and healthcare. So we're just one piece of a much larger movement. Our piece might be a little slower, behind times, not as far advanced, but we're trying our best to keep up. And interestingly enough, in the early 1900s, when healthcare system was evaluated in the United States and it was found to be a vast wasteland of diploma mills without really much content to it, Abraham Flexner suggested many innovations and many changes that needed to be brought back to medical education in order to make it more successful. And one of the ones he mentioned, it's not as well known, was to integrate humanities into medical education, because the human experience is so much a part of health. And over time, the science has just accelerated at a rapid rate. The types of therapies we have now were not imaginable even when I was a medical student a few years ago. And so the humanities have slowly gotten squeezed out of medical training. And it's never going to take over from science. It shouldn't. But we're hoping to reintroduce it in small ways.
Up until now, we've been speaking mostly about the role of art in physician and other medical professionals' training. We can get back to that, but for now, let's turn to the use of art in patient care. And that's where you come in, Megan. Can you tell us what the Zakim Center is?
It's the Leonard P. Zakim Center for Integrative Therapies and Healthy Living at Dana-Farber. And it was the dream of a cancer patient and activist, Lenny Zakim, to have a center that addresses the needs of the humanities that Dr. Katz was just mentioning, all under one roof. And 25 years ago, the Zakim Center was established. So November 2000, we're coming up upon the 25th anniversary of this year of the center.
Is this an outpatient facility?
Yes. Yep. It's an outpatient facility.
You're an art therapist. How do you integrate your work as a therapist with the care of the patients?
Yeah. So we do that a couple different ways in the Zakim Center. Patients can choose which method works best for them. So we have some longitudinal group programming. So we have 8-week groups. For one example is journaling for self-care, where we'll meet with a cohort of patients virtually and we'll engage in conversations about self-care and journaling practice, and then we'll have active time to journal together as a group. I also see patients individually, and that occurs virtually as well. So I'll meet with people who are experiencing cancer treatment, or maybe they just finished their treatment and they're navigating life as it is now. So really, I just check in with the individual that I'm working with, see how they're doing, see what comes into the room that day. And then we work together to see what sort of art modality, what sort of arts expression can help them with their goals for that day. So maybe someone's feeling really overwhelmed and they just have so much on their mind and they don't really know what to do with it as like a running dialogue of thoughts. We might use just simple art materials like markers and paper and have them write down everything that's going on, all the thoughts that are in their head. It doesn't have to be spelled correctly. It can be scribbles. Maybe it's more of a texture or a color to represent how they're feeling. And then once it's out of their head and on the paper, then we'll figure out together, what do we want to do with this? Some people want to fold it up really nicely and put it away maybe in an envelope or a box. Other people might want to discharge that energy and really crumple it up and rip it up and then stomp on it and then throw it away. Other people might want to tear up the paper, look at what the torn pieces in front of them, and maybe they want to create something new out of those torn pieces that are in front of them. And so then we'll take another piece of paper and they'll create with those torn pieces, put them on the new paper, and maybe add something that needs to be added. Maybe it's a word, maybe it's a phrase, maybe it's an intention. And so it's sort of a, to circle back to your question, that's where the therapy piece comes in, where I'm really attuning with the person that I'm working with. We're communicating through words and also arts expression, and then working together to see how to best support them in this moment. I work with primarily patients who are outpatient, and we have different avenues for their participation based on their interests or their needs. We have a calendar of services. We have many drop-in groups that people can choose to attend whenever it works for their schedule. So some examples are doodling for stress reduction. So we'll have a virtual Zoom meeting where I introduce a doodling idea for participants, and then we put on some music and people just get into the flow and doodle. It can be my suggested doodle, or they can create anything that feels meaningful to them for that time in that supportive creative community. We also have different mindfulness meditation practices that we offer. We have a virtual sound bath experience with crystal singing bowls for a sound bath meditation. And then we also have programming where patients and caregivers can virtually attend a guided meditation. The Zakim Center isn't just expressive arts and mindfulness practices. It's a whole integrative therapy center that provides massage, acupuncture, nutrition, healthy living, exercise consults, and then the mindfulness meditation and expressive arts is also a part of that practice.
I think what Megan said is really important, that the Zakim Center is just such a fabulous resource. And as a resource for patients with cancer, it is an amazing comprehensive program to look at the whole human being and all aspects of alternative healthcare.
Are there programs like this throughout the country, or is this unique?
Yeah, the Zakim Center is an amazing place. I've learned so much there. So many of my patients have benefited. It is modeled after other programs around the country. And in fact, our co-director came from Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York, which has a very well-established program. And there's others around the country as well. But it is truly the cutting edge of talented providers of all stripes helping their patients in every way possible.
The Zakim Center provides care on an outpatient basis. You've mentioned social prescription. That's care outside of a hospital setting or even an outpatient setting. What is social prescribing and how does it work? Brooke?
Social prescribing, that could also be its own podcast. But basically, the concept behind it started, I think, around the 1980s in the UK. It's also been part of some Scandinavian countries. And the idea is really focusing on mitigating social determinants of health by providing access to resources that can help impact positive health outcomes. The idea is being healthy is not only just a medical diagnosis or a medical issue, but there can be other things like where you live, your access to resources, access to good food. There's a whole sort of host of things that can affect a person and a person's health, and those are the social determinants of health. And social prescribing helps to really fill in those gaps. So it can be access to better food resources for people, or access to assisting with understanding finances and getting finances in order. But the part that we've been talking to Megan about is this idea of arts on prescription. So it's the idea of doctors prescribing an arts visit or an arts experience to their patients by prescribing things like taking a dance class or taking an arts class or going to the theater. It can help patients. It can help with those aspects of social isolation and connecting with one another. And the U.S. is actually starting to implement this work. And Massachusetts is actually one of the first states that is trying to do arts on prescription. And at Mass General Brigham, Joel and I were able to work with colleagues there to institute a pilot program on social arts on prescription with two community health centers. And so now we're trying to expand that and work with folks like Megan at Dana-Farber to maybe offer that as an option as well. And we're working with a company called Arts Pharmacy that helps to initiate those arts on prescriptions. So it's a very complicated.
Listeners to Living Well into the Future heard about it in their early programs when we talked about food insecurity. Mm-hmm. And the food deserts and the programs to enhance nutrition and get food out. How is this paid for? Will insurance companies pay for it? Because it seems that prescription's not going to work for people who don't have the funds to use.
That's a great question, Julie. And the first step is to see whether it works or not. Because in theory, if it worked, insurance companies would pay for it. So the project that we're doing at Mass General Brigham right now is looking at blood pressure control in a group of people who have not been able to achieve great blood pressure through standard means of pharmacology. And we're introducing this extra opportunity for the providers to say, not only am I going to give you a prescription for your hydrochlorothiazide, but I'm going to give you a prescription to take a cooking class or a dance class or go to the museum or the opera and see if that actually improves their blood pressure. And the idea is that, as Brooke mentioned, that if it improves their sense of wellness and being an inclusion, it will probably decrease the barriers that sometimes keep them away from healthcare settings, and they're more likely to fill their other prescriptions. They're more likely to trust their providers and reach out if they have a concern. And in the end, the theory is that, yes, it will actually improve their blood pressure, and then the insurance companies will pay for it.
Okay. It looks like a follow-up is needed on this to see how this is going. We've spoken about using art to educate medical professionals and to heal outpatients. But another segment of the population that we haven't discussed are inpatients, their families, and other visitors. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has a Friends Art program that states its mission is to engage patients, families, and staff, and at the same time bring comfort, provide an opportunity for contemplation, and humanize the hospital experience. Brooke and Megan, you've been involved in working with and building art collections at Brigham and Women's Hospital and Mass General that provide benefits that Dana-Farber Cancer Institute does. another benefit that was striking to me was to make patients who are not white Europeans comfortable in the facilities, although I should have been aware of it since
San Antonio. There's a strong program of art in the hospitals which support local artists, as well as serving a purpose primarily to serve the community and to see people who are the patients represented in the collections.
Sure. Yeah. So one of the programs that Megan and I had a chance to work together on, and how we know each other from a few years back, is we worked on Project Heart together, which is based at Mass General Hospital. And it was started by a radiologist named Dan Chande. Dan started Project Heart for the exact reasons that you mentioned. He really wanted to diversify the art that was in the hospital. Mass General is seated in the heart of Boston, has a very diverse community surrounding it. And Dan wanted to make sure that everyone coming into the hospital saw sort of a representation of themselves. And so he worked with local artists, with community groups, to really help expand that collection. And Megan did an amazing job installing several exhibitions over the course of that. So I'll let you talk about that more because you have some great direct experience.
Sure. Yeah. The idea expanded an art exhibit that was already in practice at Mass General Hospital and the Cancer Center. So it was a program called Illuminations. There was already a rotating art exhibit that was housed in the waiting rooms of the Cancer Center. And the idea of that was to provide an outlet for patients who were just sitting there in their seats, probably feeling pretty nervous, not sure what to expect, and to help create a more welcoming environment through the environmental arts. And then Dan had the idea to actually, a lot of these art pieces that are on exhibit are of nature, which can be soothing. Many people like looking at nature images, but the thing that was really missing was artwork that reflected the diversity of the patient population that we served. And so it was just really an amazing experience to work with Dan, to meet different local artists, and to be able to select some artwork from the communities where the clinics were.
Your mission is, Joel, as you've expressed it, is to return, as you've said, the humanistic values to the medical profession. And you've been working for 25 years in this process. And during this time, we've just seen it get more mechanical, more mediated by insurance companies. But on the other hand, I see through the Center of Visual Arts, you have collaborations with 125 programs around the country. Talk about the collaborations, whether this is gaining strength, where you see this going in the future.
Thank you so much. There is definitely a growth in the field. I think Brook last year alone trained 3,000 healthcare providers at the program at the Brigham and Women's Hospital. And it's growing in size, but it's also growing in scope, more importantly. Other providers, not just in the United States, but from around the world, are working more collaboratively to build new programs. I just got back from Rome, Italy, where we were hosted by one of the medical schools in Rome. And there's a lot more energy, I would say, and concentrated energy in thinking about ways that we can provide not just technologically skilled healthcare providers, but ones that the patients can relate to and that work well in teams, as an example. So I'm not sure I have any numbers on that per se, but there certainly is more interest. There's a little bit more funding, more medical schools around the country that I'm more familiar with than the nursing schools do utilize the humanities in a whole variety of complementary ways. And they're, like us, absolutely willing to share and partner And as you accurately mentioned, we have partnerships all over the country now, all over the world, where we're teaching each other how to do a better job.
And I would just add to that, I think one sort of seminal moment was when the Association of American Medical Colleges published their FRAME report, which stands for the Fundamental Role of the Arts and the Humanities in Medical Education. And that was in 2019. And so to have a major medical group say, yes, the humanities are helpful in medical training, and have a pretty extensive report with great examples, as Joel said, from across the humanities, not just visual arts, but music and dance as well, was a great moment to see that sort of recognition of where the humanities can live.
And I'll just mention that came out of an observation by the then president of the AA, Dr. Kirsch, who looked at surveys of what patients thought about their medical care. And they were absolutely 100% confident that their providers knew about the technical aspects of pharmacology and taking care of patients and how to set their casts and do their operations, but they were much, much less confident in their communication abilities and their trust in those particular people, which I think motivated the AAMC to say, gee, is there a better way that we could teach these soft skills?
Do you have a checklist of, for example, we want to achieve collegiality or enhance observation skills?
Well, I think the beauty of this type of work is that each local institution can decide what their own needs are. So again, I started out with physical examination. That's one of my passions in life. But other groups have used it to explore completely other areas where they find specific deficit. So as an example, diversity, equity, inclusion, patients, as mentioned, feeling part of the hospitals that they go to, those are really tough things to teach in traditional medical education. And there are a number of really great groups, one in particular in Baltimore at Johns Hopkins, who have used art museums as a way to specifically address bias and equity in healthcare. And there are many other wonderful examples of that. You asked me what my checklist is, what my to-do list is. For me, one of the areas that I'm most interested and passionate about is bringing this work directly back to the patients. And so, as I mentioned, I'm not a art therapist, expressive arts therapist. I'm a medical educator. And what Brooke and I do at Brigham and Women's Hospital is we teach healthcare providers. But what I would love to do in the next phase is to bring healthcare providers and patients to the art museum together and have them look together and learn about each other to become more engaged in their healthcare teams as teams to help them understand and trust each other better. So I think there are an enormous number of frontiers that are just needing better and more work in this area.
That ties into the fact that you have brought slow learning back to the Museum of Fine Arts. Brooke, you were at the museum for many years. What was the thinking? What are you trying to achieve by adding that element to the curricula there?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I worked at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston for 12 years, and they just installed a new exhibition of Georgia O'Keeffe and Henry Moore's work. And so they were trying to think of a way of engaging participants in their work, getting them looking closely. Obviously, that's a whole piece of Georgia O'Keeffe's work, like looking really in depth and really closely at works or pieces of nature, flowers, and other things. And so they reached out to Joel and I because they knew about our work and focus on slow looking and close looking, and asked us if we would be willing to record a couple of audio guide stops in that exhibition. So we have three audio guide stops, and Joel has done an introduction about the concepts of slow looking, the benefits of slow looking, and then the three stops that I did each walk people through different strategies strategies for slow looking and encourage people to spend at least a few minutes. It's a very busy gallery, so it's sometimes hard to slow down, but try and spend at least a few minutes looking at one particular work of art. And so we use visual thinking strategies as one component. Another one encourages people to reflect with the friend or family member they may have come to the museum with and talk about the work of art together with them, and also find a piece that brings them sort of a sense of peace and a sense of calm. So thinking about different ways to engage across the gallery space. So it was a wonderful opportunity for us to work with the museum again, and I think came out of this work that they were familiar with that we've been doing.
I tried it. It's hard. It's hard to slow down. Why do you want people to slow down? And what is the health? We talk generally, but is there a health benefit, Megan and Brooke?
Again, I'm not a doctor, but I would say, I think specifically in this case for these sort of slow looking stops, I think we live in very hectic, busy lives, constantly being bombarded with information, news clips, social media feeds. And to take a moment to just slow down, a lot of what I do sometimes around slow looking is some breathing exercises to get people just to center themselves, to feel that they're in that moment and present in that moment. And so I think it can just help in that way. It's also a way to connect with other people, which I think in this time where people are experiencing a lot of loneliness and social isolation, this is an opportunity for people to connect with one another on sort of an analog level, not through social media or through an app or something, but really in person together. So that's my armchair health perspective.
Megan, I do think you have also anything before I ask Joel if there's a neurophysiological response?
Yeah. Also to support what Brooke said, really being fully present in the moment. So very mindful. And also it gives us the opportunity to connect to perhaps awe. When you look at a painting and you're looking so intently and you're fully taking in the details, maybe the scale of the piece or the colors, and it really helps to connect people to a sense of awe or joy even. And I wanted to share that the Zakim Center also has a partnership with the Museum of Fine Arts, Arts Educators. And so we did facilitate a workshop on the Henry Moore and Georgia O'Keeffe exhibit. And the MFA Arts Educator presented a slideshow of the work, facilitated a process of slow looking, essentially, of the Georgia O'Keeffe pieces. And then the Zakim Center had mailed art supplies to the workshop participants. And so we all opened up our packages of art supplies and we created pieces of art in the style of Georgia O'Keeffe. So another opportunity for using the arts for self-expression, for mindful practices, for connecting with community and finding joy.
Fabulous. And to get back to the medical portion of it, is there a neurophysiological or physiological reaction? Is this something that measurable, that people heal faster or have better results or any of those things when you talk about patients?
It's hard for me to top what Brooke and Megan just beautifully articulated, and I agree with all of that. But I think there are two sort of very concrete ways where I do think it can very specifically improve patient care. One is the idea of creativity and the idea of active engagement. And I'll tell you a quick story in 1 second on that issue. And so I really encourage people to do doodling, whatever level of art and type of art is good for you. I think people feel better. And I think there is neurologic evidence to suggest do better when they themselves are more actively engaged and less of a passive participant in illness. And then the second way that it helps is if your doctors are thinking slowly, that is probably a good thing for you as a patient, that you don't want to be a tiny cog in a huge wheel of the healthcare system, which it's so easy to become. And that is the goal of our Brigham and Women's program, is to try and move the needle on healthcare providers who are more attentive to their own biases and are aware of these interactions and feel comfortable, as I mentioned, balancing ambiguity and uncertainty with decisive action through better communication. And I, as I was listening to Megan and Brooke, I was reminded of one of my own patients. I don't want to call her out here, but I have her book right here. She happens to be an artist, and she is going through a serious illness that put her out of commission for a while. And so when I saw her last, she gave me a book. And what she had done is, as people sent her flowers when she was recovering, she was having trouble sleeping because of the illness itself, the pain and the discomfort from the illness. And so she would go down at night so she wasn't disturbing her family, and she would draw the flowers. And at the end of this, she published a book of all of her drawings and then gave them to her friends and her healthcare providers who had helped her. It was just such a absolutely beautiful example of the transformative power of art in health.
Fantastic. Thank you. Thank you to each of you, Megan and Joel and Brooke, for speaking with me today for Living Well Into the Future.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And good health to your listeners.
In this episode, you heard about the innovative ways that art is being used in medical training and how art can have a positive impact on patients, healthcare providers, and the general public. If you have gained a new understanding and perhaps an increased appreciation for art in your life or in your community, talk to coworkers, friends, and family about it, and let us know. In our next episode, we will turn to two successful artists, Margaret Craig and Ricky Almendarez, to dig deeper into the artistic process, the development of works of art, and how they connect communities, communicate concepts relevant currently and universally, and require and inspire resilience. We hope you'll tune in. Our thanks from me, Julie B. Adler, to Berkshire Alley, WTBR-FM 89.7 Pittsfield, and the Berkshire Eagle for their support.
We hope that you enjoyed this episode and found food for thought and further discussion with family, friends, and the wider community. Perhaps you'll take some time for slow looking at art or exploring visual thinking strategies with friends and coworkers. If you want to repeat this episode and hear the others in our series on resilience, as well as our episodes on food, housing, climate, and health, you can find them at Living Well Into the Future on 89.7 WTBR Pittsfield, 88.1 WSBR Lee, WTBRFM.com, Apple Podcasts, and other streaming services. Subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. We invite you to contribute to Living Well Into the Future with your comments and suggestions for topics and even guests. Write to us at lwitf22@gmail.com or through our website at livingwellintothefuture.com, where you can find show notes, past episodes, and information about our guests.
This podcast is produced by Julie Kopenheffer. Our music is written and performed by Michael Kopenheffer. The opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and not of WTBR-FM, Berkshire Alley, or the Berkshire Eagle, or the LWITF production team.